From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Stephen King describes the car accident that nearly killed him and what it was like to experience the kind of pain he had only imagined in his fiction. He writes about the accident and reflects on his work in his book On Writing. It's just out in paperback. Also today, an interview and reading with Billy Collins. He's just been named the next poet laureate. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Calm Air pilots have voted to accept a contract proposal. The vote ends a three-month strike against the regional airline. Federal mediators had helped Calm Air and the pilots' union reach a tentative agreement last week. U.S. military officials are responding to what they call a non-specific but credible threat against Americans in the Persian Gulf. They're cutting short a Marines training mission in Jordan and moving Navy ships out of Bahrain. After years of Republican opposition to raising fuel efficiency standards for light trucks, an influential GOP lawmaker said today it's time for a new look at getting more mileage from SUVs and minivans. NPR's David Wellna reports from the Capitol.
Congressman Joe Barton, the Texas Republican who chairs the Energy and Air Quality Subcommittee, called changing fuel efficiency standards a politically delicate issue. Still, he said he's asked the Energy Department what a reasonable standard for such vehicles might be and was told the administration is working on the answer. David Nemso, who heads the Alliance to Save Energy, said fuel efficiency standards already save 3 million barrels of oil a day in the U.S.
Unfortunately, because light trucks and SUVs are treated more leniently than passenger cars, we're missing the opportunity to save at least 1 million barrels per day just from that part of the sector. So you need to tighten the fuel economy standards in general, and particularly for light trucks and SUVs.
Administration officials say they'll make a decision based on a National Academy of Sciences study due next month. David Wellna, NPR News, the Capitol.
As part of the peace process following 10 years of civil war, rebels from Sierra Leone's much-feared Revolutionary United Front, or RUF, have released 126 child soldiers to United Nations peacekeepers in the West African country. NPR's Ivan Watson reports from Tongo, Sierra Leone.
In a bombed-out building in the diamond mining town of Tongo, 10 boys held hands with UN officials at a ceremony for the children's release. They later sang a rebel anthem promising to bring power to the people with machine guns. They and more than 120 other child soldiers will be flown to a temporary camp where UN officials will try to reunite the children with their families. The UN says more than 5,000 children fought as soldiers throughout Sierra Leone's 10-year conflict. Many were kidnapped and forced to participate in the RUF rebels' campaign of terror against the civilian population. But it's the rebels themselves who called for this latest peace initiative, and the RUF commander says he has more child soldiers that have yet to be released. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Tongo, Sierra Leone.
Profit warnings from pharmaceuticals maker Merck and other companies contributed to more falls in the stock markets today. The Dow Industrials dropped 110 points, closing at 10,604 in active trading. The Nasdaq lost 24 points to finish at 2034. This is NPR News. Democrats in the Senate have accused Republicans of trying to derail the patient's Bill of Rights, but said that they will keep fighting for it even in the face of a presidential veto threat. Today, Democrats defeated a Republican amendment that would have given self-employed people health insurance tax breaks a year early. Republicans today proposed giving employers firm protection from lawsuits. Democrats said that they would limit but not eliminate employer liability in the bill. Sara Lee Corporation pleaded guilty today in Michigan to selling tainted meat in 1998. The meat killed at least 15 people. NPR's Marianne Akers reports.
Today alone, United has had to cancel 107 flights. Half that amount is due to maintenance problems, but the rest of the cancellations are due to damage from the hailstorm that hit Denver Wednesday. A United spokeswoman says hail as big as baseballs damaged three dozen of United's jets. Whitney Staley says maintenance crews are working round the clock to repair the extensive damage, but it's not likely that all flights will be operational this weekend. Although the damage occurred in Denver, which is a United hub, it's disrupting the airline's schedule nationwide. The problem is especially bad in the Northeast because bad weather is delaying all airlines' flights to and from the region. United says it is making accommodations this weekend to rebook passengers onto other flights. Marianne Akers, NPR News, Chicago.
The Bush administration has asked for an investigation to find out if import restrictions on steel are needed to help faltering U.S. producers. Two Republican congressmen say President Bush has formally asked the U.S. International Trade Commission to start that investigation. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stephen King was nearly killed in June of 1999 while taking his daily walk. He was walking along the gravel shoulder of Route 5, a two-lane highway near his home in Maine, when he was struck by a van driven by Brian Smith, who had several prior convictions for speeding and reckless driving. A little over a year ago, Smith was found dead in his home. A toxicology test indicated he died of an accidental overdose, a combination of medication and alcohol. King is still recovering from his injuries, which included 9 breaks in his right leg, his right knee split almost directly down the middle, a fracture of his right hip, 4 broken ribs, and a scalp laceration that required nearly 30 stitches. His spine was chipped in 8 places. Yet he's still writing. His book on writing is now out in paperback. It's part memoir, part reflection on his craft. The last chapter is about his accident. When we spoke about 1 year ago, he read an excerpt.
Most of the sight lines along the mile of Route 5, which I walk, are good. But there is one stretch, a short, steep hill, where a pedestrian walking north can see very little of what might be coming his way. I was 3/4 of the way up this hill when Brian Smith, the owner and operator of the Dodge van, came over the crest. He wasn't on the road. He was on the shoulder. My shoulder. I had perhaps 3/4 of a second to register this. It was just time enough to think, my God, I'm going to be hit by a school bus. I started to turn to my left. There is a break in my memory here. On the other side of it, I'm on the ground, looking at the back of the van, which is now pulled off the road and tilted to one side. This recollection is very clear and very sharp, more like a snapshot than a memory. There is dust around the van's taillights. The license plate and the back windows are dirty. I register these things with no thought that I have been in an accident or of anything else. It's a snapshot, that's all. I'm not thinking. My head has been swapped clean. There's another little break in my memory here, and then I am very carefully wiping palmfuls of blood out of my eyes with my left hand. When my eyes are reasonably clear, I look around and see a man sitting on a nearby rock. He has a cane drawn across his lap. This is Brian Smith, 42 years of age, the man who hit me with his van. Smith has got quite the driving record. He has racked up nearly a dozen vehicle-related offenses. Smith wasn't looking at the road on the afternoon our lives came together because his Rottweiler had jumped from the very rear of his van into the back seat area, where there was an igloo cooler with some meat stored inside. The Rottweiler's name is Bullet. Smith has another Rottweiler at home. That one is named Pistol. Bullet started to nose at the lid of the cooler. Smith turned around and tried to push Bullet away. He was still looking at Bullet and pushing his head away from the cooler when he came over the top of the knoll, still looking and pushing when he struck me. Smith told friends later that he thought he'd hit a small deer until he noticed my bloody spectacles lying on the front seat of his van. They were knocked from my face when I tried to get out of Smith's way. The frames were bent and twisted, but the lenses were unbroken. They are the lenses I'm wearing now as I write this. Smith sees I'm awake and tells me help is on the way. He speaks calmly, even cheerily. His look as he sits on his rock with his cane drawn across his lap, is one of pleasant commiseration. Ain't the two of us just had the shittiest luck, it says. He and Bullet left the campground where they were staying, he later tells an investigator, because he wanted some of those Maz's buys they have up to the stoa. When I hear this little detail some weeks later, it occurs to me that I have nearly been killed by a character out of one of my own novels. It's almost funny.
That's Stephen King reading from his new memoir on writing. Stephen King, welcome back to Fresh Air, and it's so great to still have you with us.
It's nice to be here, but I tell people nowadays it's nice to be anywhere.
Right. Did Smith say anything to you, anything else to you, as you were laying there drifting in and out of consciousness after he hit you?
He said, I've never had so much as a parking ticket in my life, and here it is my bad luck to hit the best-selling writer in the world. And I think he said, I loved all your movies.
Did he really say that?
Yeah.
So he's lying to you as you're lying there, nearly dying?
Well, he said he had never had so much as a parking ticket, and God knows he had a lot of traffic offenses. We don't want to speak ill of the dead if we can help it, because he did die last month, and on my birthday, as a matter of fact, which
no.
is a little bit eerie.
Yeah.
He and I share the same middle name as well. We're both Edwins. We were. Now I'm, well, never mind.
You know, in that reading, you say that it made you think that he was like a character in your fiction. Were there other things that made you think of him that way?
Well, God knows that I've lived in rural Maine for a lot of years. It's where I grew up, and it's where my wife and I live now, in a town of about 900 people. And we don't want to say that Brian Smith is or was a type, because I don't necessarily believe that there are types, but he had a certain backcountry quality with the Rottweiler dogs and the old van, and it's really tough, Terry, to talk about Brian Smith without making him sound like a sort of Faulknerian stereotype, and so I'd just as soon steer clear of the whole issue. He was like a character in a Stephen King book, but only because he seemed like a real Maine type to me.
You were understandably really angry with the sentence that he was given. He was basically given a suspended driver's license for a year. But when he was found dead in his home toward the end of September, what was your reaction to his death?
Oh, I was shocked, and I was sorry as well. When he hit me, Brian Smith was 42. When he died, he was 43, and 43 isn't a natural span, I don't believe, for a man in 21st century America.
Did you feel like this was like some kind of larger form of punishment, or that his death was related in any kind of larger way to this accident?
No, I don't think that the world works that neatly, and I don't think that justice is meted out by fate, or else people like Adolf Eichmann wouldn't have lived so long, so well, before anybody caught up to them. And God knows there are enough people whose crimes would make anything that Brian Smith ever did look very small change in comparison, who have never been punished at all. My feeling about Brian Smith was pretty simple. He had a very long record of driving convictions, and an even longer record. In the book, I talk about the dozen or so traffic convictions. But in fact, he had been brought before the courts on twice that many charges, where the charges were either dismissed or they under the seal of the court because he was a juvenile. These go back to the time of his driver's permit. And we're not dealing with somebody here who is a bad person, or in the sense that you'd want to see somebody sent to jail for robbery or murder or rape or any of those things. Brian Smith was just a bad, negligent driver. And I wanted to see him take it, not necessarily put in jail, but certainly put into a situation where he'd be forced to consider the way that he was behaving, you know, on a wide range of issues, from the way that he was driving to the way that he was living.
Tell us about how you're feeling now, your ability to walk and all that.
Well, the accident was in June of 1999, and I was totally incapacitated at that point. If there was a bone on the right side of my body, it was broken, with the exception of my head, which was only concussed. And this is about 16 months down the line, and I'm able to walk fairly well. I have a limp that I think is a lot more noticeable toward the end of the day as things start to hurt more. I've continued to work rehab in order to increase my range of motion. It doesn't seem to do a whole lot for some of the pain issues that are centered around the hip, but most of the leg is pretty pain-free now, and I'm grateful for that, and it's nice to be able to walk at all. The way it works, when you are in the hospital and you're stuck in bed and you've got various appliances attached to your body, you say to people, will I ever get out of this bed? And they say, the chances are good. And when you get out of bed, you say, will I ever be able to bend my leg again? And they say, the chances are good that you will. Most people do. So that, and that continues to go on, will I walk again? And the last question, the one that I'm working on right now, as I said to the doctor about the orthopedist, David Brown, who operated on my leg, I said, I'd really like to be able to play tennis. Will I be able to do that maybe next summer? And he said, I think that the chances are fairly good that you'll be able to run again and play tennis. So nobody comes out and says yes. They just tell you that the chances are good, I suppose, because they don't want you to be depressed. But I'm walking, I'm thinking, and I'm really, really grateful to be alive.
Do you need a walker or a cane, anything like that?
No. I went from two crutches. I went from a wheelchair to a walker, and walker to crutches, and two crutches to one crutch, and put the last crutch aside in July, and I've been walking unaided since then. My wife says that she's encouraged by the trail of discarded appliances I've left behind.
I'm glad you've left them behind. For your writing, you've had to imagine people in extreme circumstances and imagine them in agony. Did your accident feel like anything you had imagined for fiction?
It all seemed familiar to me in the sense that there was nothing involved with the whole deal that I didn't expect. But the odd thing is that when you've been seriously hurt, there's a kind of numbing shock that sets in. And as a result, everything is, there's no surprise involved with any of the things that seem to go on. You just sort of, the things come and you deal with them. It's like being cast adrift and riding the waves. They took me to a hospital in Western Maine and did a few things to me. They took a look at the injuries and decided that they couldn't treat them there. And they got a life flight helicopter to take me to Central Maine Medical Center in Lewiston. And while I was on the flight, my lung collapsed, and I can remember one of the guys saying, oh, shit, we've got to do something about this. And I can remember the crackle of them unwrapping something and somebody saying that they were going to stick me, and then I could breathe again because they'd intubated me and pumped up my lung again. And all of this was just a sort of sense of, well, this is what's happening now. You become a totally passive person in a way. You recognize immediately that you've been seriously hurt, and that you can't deal with your own life, and that you're going to have to depend on other people to pull you through. So you just kind of let go. And that's pretty much the way that I always saw things happening in my books, which doesn't surprise me that much, because I think the imagination, when you really use it at top quality, when you're seeing really well, the imagination really knows what the reality is.
My guest is Stephen King. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview recorded 1 year ago with Stephen King after the publication of his book On Writing. That book has just come out in paperback. He's still recovering from the car accident that nearly killed him 2 years ago. In an interview in Salon magazine before the accident, you said, "As a kid, my mother used to say when we were scared, whatever you're afraid of, say it three times fast and it will never happen." And that's what I've done in my fiction. Basically, I've said out loud the things that really terrify me, and I've turned them into fictions, and they've made a very nice living for me, and it seems to have worked. Did you ever feel that this time the horror stories jinxed you, that something that you feared and had written about was coming true?
No, it never even crossed my mind. It's strange because off and on in my career as a writer, I have certainly written about car crashes and about characters who've been hurt or injured in car crashes. There's a little boy who's killed by a truck in Pet Sematary. And in a book that's done in manuscript but hasn't been polished yet and readied for publication called From a Buick 8, one of the main characters' father is killed in an accident very similar to the one that almost killed me. But I only use those things in my stories because cars and traffic accidents are a part of our lives. They're something that, unfortunately, most of us relate to, probably at a rate of three or four times as much. That is to say, three or four times as many people either have been in a car accident themselves or know somebody who has, as have been injured with gunshots. So it's a part of the American experience, and as such, of course, I've written about it, but I never felt that I jinxed myself, no.
When you were on Fresh Air a few years ago and we were talking about the things that scared you most as a kid, you mentioned something that you also describe in your new book On Writing. You talked about how when you were a kid you had strep throat, and after that you had a terrible ear infection. And in treating it, the doctor had to, with a needle, puncture your eardrum on three separate occasions to let the infection drain. And it was the worst agony you'd ever experienced. And of course, the doctor, before doing the procedure, kept saying that it wasn't going to hurt. You've had to go through excruciating pain as an adult now as a result of the accident and the procedures and therapies that you've had to do as well. How is dealing with the pain of the accident, the surgeries, the procedures, dealing with that pain as an adult compared to dealing with it as a child?
Well, as an adult, I always felt a lot more as though I were a participant in what was happening to me. For instance, the therapy, and anybody who's been in a bone-crunching accident knows that it's a very, very difficult procedure to go through. When I woke up, I was in something that's called an external fixator, which is a halo that goes over the leg, and it mobilizes the bone. It also immobilizes the joints so that from June 19th, I think, until probably, toward the end of July, I never bent my knee. And in the old days, the 20s and 30s, when people recovered from this sort of accident, their leg was more or less frozen in place, so it became an organic crutch. And nowadays, at least we have therapeutic techniques to restore mobility to the leg, but it's very, very painful. And I can remember, in the On Writing book, I talk about the having my ears lanced to let out, to drain moisture and pus that was behind the eardrum. But as a child, when you're faced with a procedure like that, you're in a uniquely powerless situation because you don't understand what's going on. And you're powerless to stop it in any case. You were mentioning I had to go back three times. And the first time when I was told, "Don't worry, this won't hurt," I believed it. The second time, I almost believed it. And the third time, I knew that it wasn't true, but I was still powerless to stop it. And to me, that's the ingredient of a nightmare, even down to the fact that the doctor never called me Stephen. He called me Robert. He would say, "Now, Robert, lie down. This won't hurt." And in my panicky child's way, I'm thinking, "Of course it will hurt. Of course it will hurt. You're even lying about what my name is." But when you get to be an adult, Although it still hurts, the pain is still there. I felt as though I were something of a participant in my own therapy, so that the first step was to get the knee to flex enough so that the leg would come down and the heel would touch the floor. And the pain of just that was excruciating, and I just filled the house with my howls. I can't imagine how my poor wife ever stood it, but the physical therapist, Ann, just would laugh and say, "You can do a little bit more, Stephen." And I'd think, "No, I can't. I can't do any more, Ann. Stop it. Let me stop." And she wouldn't, and then come the weights on the leg and all the rest of it. But you, at least you know what's going on, and you know, understand what the stakes are. And when it came to having my ear lanced, children just don't understand.
You know, in Misery, the character, the main character, is a writer who's seriously injured, and the woman taking care of him, his number one fan, is really torturing him and not giving him therapy. Did the nurses and therapists who you worked with make zillions of Misery jokes?
You know, they'd all read Misery, but and they worked for an outfit called the Bangor Area Visiting Nurses. These are nurses who go into the home and give home care. And I think one of them told me toward the end of the period where I needed full-time nursing that they had all read it and they had all been called into the office by their superior and told in no uncertain terms, don't make any Misery jokes.
And did they restrain themselves?
They did. They were great.
Stephen King recorded last year. His book On Writing is now out in paperback. We'll continue the interview in the second half of the show. Here's King singing Stand By Me, the song used in his film adaptation of the same name. Warren Zevon is at the piano. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
When the night has come, the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see. I won't cry, I won't cry, no, I won't shed a tear, just as long.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Delta Trade Paperback, a division of Random House, publisher of Driving Mr. Albert, A Trip Across America with Einstein's Brain, a work of nonfiction by Michael Paternity. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Stephen King, and we hear from the new poet laureate, Billy Collins. He writes about subjects like forgetfulness, stopping smoking, insomnia, canceled vacations, and the pictures in the Victoria's Secret catalog. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Stephen King. He's still recovering from the car accident that nearly killed him 2 years ago, but he continues to write. His book on writing is part reflection on his craft, part memoir. It's now out in paperback. We spoke 1 year ago when it was published in hardcover. You write in the book that at some point you had to admit to yourself that you had serious problems with alcohol and with cocaine. Because your wife organized an intervention, you finally did something about it and got over those addictions. After the accident, you had to take some pretty heavy painkillers.
Right.
And those are pretty addictive. What's it like having to go back on drugs, addictive drugs, knowing that you'd had a problem with them and that you have what you describe as an addictive personality?
One of the ways that... The way that it was described best to me, you know that people who are alcoholics and drug addicts generally get involved with support groups. And I heard one guy who'd been through this himself describe it as being in one of those log rolling competitions where you get up on a log and you see how long you can stay up before you get dumped back into the river. If I thought anything was unfair about what had happened to me, it was that after struggling and winning a battle to get off all sorts of drugs and alcohol, and I just didn't have a problem with beer and cocaine. I was an addictive personality, period. I was smoking two packs of cigarettes a day. I loved Listerine. I loved NyQuil. You name it, boy, if it would change your consciousness, I was all for that. And I was able to jettison almost all of those substances out of my life. And suddenly you wake up in a hospital bed and you've got a fentanyl patch on your arm and you're jacked up on morphine and you've got all these different medications. I was as grossed out by that, I think, as I was by the injuries, thinking, my God, I'm a junkie again. And the way that I deal with it, rightly or wrongly, is to try and make sure that you never exceed the dosage that you're supposed to have for things like Percocet or Vicodin or any of those things. And as long as you stay below the prescribed levels, and as long as you're making a reasonable effort to get clean, that's a good thing to do. On the other hand, as other people say in those programs that I attend, I didn't get sober to suffer. And if I'm in a situation where I'm miserable and medication will help that suffering, I'm going to take it.
You still have to take painkillers?
I'm almost off, but I still do take some, yeah, toward the end of the day. Mostly, though, I'm clean.
Yeah, as you point out in your new book on writing, one of the plots that has interested you in several of your books is, if there is a God, why do such terrible things happen? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the themes in The Stand, Desperation, The Green Mile. Is that the kind of thing you were wondering about yourself after the accident? And I'm wondering if you believe in God, if you did before the accident, if you did after the accident.
Oh, I've always believed in God. I also think that's the sort of thing that either comes as part of the equipment, the capacity to believe, or at some point in your life, when you're in a position where you actually need help from a power greater than yourself, you simply make an agreement. I will believe in God because it will make my life easier and richer to believe than not to believe. So I choose to believe. Then, of course, you're left with these questions. Why did this happen to me? You know, it's there's a story that I've told a couple of times about Job. You know, the sorrows of Job. Job loses his wife, he loses his children, he's covered with diseases, his land is taken away from him, all these sorrows. And finally, Job goes down to the coast of the ocean and faces the waves and says, God, all these terrible things have happened to me, all these things, and I still love you, but I want to know Why? Why did these things have to happen to me? Why did they have to happen to Job, your good and faithful servant? And this cyclone comes down, and it comes across the waves, and it stops in front of him, and it says, Job, I guess you just pissed me off. And that's one way of looking at how God treats us. I can also say, God, why did this have to happen to me when if I get another step back, you know, the guy misses me entirely? Then God says to me in the voice that I hear in my head, which probably comes from the boys in the basement as much as from God, the muses that I have. These guys say, on the other hand, Steve, if you'd taken another step forward, you would have been killed. You didn't have any permanent nerve damage. You've got a numb place on your leg, but your foot works and your leg works. So there are all these things. And then these voices can go on and say, Steve, why don't you get serious? 6 million Jews were killed in the 30s and 40s as a part of Hitler's little ethnic cleansing program, and 1 million more Bosnian Serbs were killed in their program of ethnic cleansing in the mid-90s. So what are you complaining about? You got a little busted hip. Why don't you just, you know, pick yourself up and dust yourself off and get over it and don't be worrying about things you can't understand. So again, I think that you make an agreement and you say to yourself, okay, there's a God. Why? Because I choose to believe there's a God. Believing makes my life better than not believing. Why did this happen to me? It happened to me for some good purpose. What is that good purpose? I don't know, but I choose to believe it's good because to believe it's bad would bum out my whole day.
I had read that you were going to buy the van that struck you and smash it. Did that actually happen?
It never did happen. The van has been cubed. When I was in the hospital, mostly unconscious, my wife got a lawyer who's just a friend of the family. My son and his son went to school together, so we know him really well. And she got in touch with him and said, buy it so that somebody else doesn't buy it and decide to break it up and sell it on eBay, on the Internet. And so he did, and for about 6 months, I did have these sort of fantasies of smashing the van up. But my wife, I don't always listen to her the first time, but sooner or later, she usually gets through, and what she says makes more sense than what I had planned. And her thought was that the best thing to do would be to very quietly remove it from this plane of existence, which is what we did.
Oh, and you can't say how?
Sure I can. It went through a car crusher. It's a little cube somewhere.
Oh, so rather than you attacking it yourself, I got it. Oh, that's...
Yeah.
And did you keep the cube?
No, I didn't. I don't really know what happened to the cube. But my idea about the van had always been to sort of smash it up the way that in the carnies of my youth, sometimes somebody would put a car up on in the back of a flatbed truck and charge a quarter for three smacks with a sledgehammer. And I thought we could do that for charity. And it still, at times, seems to me like a good idea. But I have sort of a carnival mind, and my wife is a little bit more sober.
So great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
It's so great to talk to you. Just to hear your voice in my headphones is nice.
Thank you, and continued good luck with your recovery. It sounds like you've really been doing terrifically so far. And thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for talking with me.
Stephen King recorded 1 year ago after the publication of his book, On Writing. It's now out in paperback. He's still recovering from his accident. Coming up, the new poet laureate, Billy Collins. This is Fresh Air. This week, Billy Collins was appointed the new poet laureate by the Librarian of Congress. Collins is a poet with a popular following. He often writes with wit about experiences familiar to many of us, like insomnia, the difficulty of stopping smoking, or driving by the cemetery where your parents are buried. His greatest hit is a poem that describes the frustration of not being able to recall a name or a book you've read. It's called Forgetfulness. Here's Collins reading it.
The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion. The entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. It is as if one by one the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye, and you watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away. A state flower, perhaps, the address of an uncle, the capital of Paraguay. Whatever it is you are struggling to remember, it is not poised on the tip of your tongue, not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a dark mythological river whose name begins with an L, as far as you can recall, well on your own way to oblivion, where you will join those who have even forgotten how to swim and how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart.
Billy Collins. He'll assume his duties as poet laureate in the fall. A new collection of his poems will be published in September. His most recent collection is called Picnic Lightning. Collins is a distinguished professor of literature at Lehman College, City University of New York. I spoke with Billy Collins in 1998.
Did your poems always stick to ordinary life and always have the directness that they have, or did you ever write in other styles?
No, I wrote in awful styles when I started, mostly slavishly imitative styles.
Of who?
William Carlos Williams, Wallace Stevens, Ferlinghetti, producing really awful versions of almost unintentional parodies of these people. And it was really before I found my voice. I mean, that expression is one I'm not happy with. It sounds like it's like your voice is slipped behind the couch or something. But I think when I started to write poems that I felt only I could have written, and I think that's the point you either get to or you don't in writing poems, I felt that I had released a lot of myself into the poems, and they did become, as you said, more relaxed. They started out, at least, on very conversational notes. I think it's a sign of my overall obsession with attracting and keeping readers. I mean, all the poems have different subjects, but I think the ultimate subject of all these poems is the engagement that takes place between the poem and the reader. I don't think readers enjoy being led down a flight of stairs into an unlit basement, and that's the feeling I get from reading quite a few contemporary poems.
Well, I know exactly what you mean, and there's a lot of poems where I'll really love the beginning, and then I just totally get lost deeper in, and the imagery becomes so obscure. I might like the way the language sounds, but I have no idea sometimes what the poet is communicating.
Yes, I think there are several reasons for obscurity in poetry, and one of them is just maybe hide the banality of what's really being said. I'm not really greatly concerned with the large issue of what the audience is for American poetry, but I'm very deeply concerned about the audience for my poetry, and I try to address that concern in every poem I write, usually by starting out on some familiar note so that the poem at least begins with something we share in common. Then I feel the poem can take the reader on an unfamiliar ride, perhaps, and take him to a place of surprise toward the end. But I really think that I'm supplying half of a possible engagement, and that the second half of that takes place in the reader's mind.
There's a poem I want you to read called Asso Buco, and this is really a poem about contentment. Is contentment a difficult thing to write about?
It is nearly impossible to write about, I think. I think it's very challenging to write about because serious art, at least since the Romantics, since about the beginning of the 19th century. Serious art takes sadness as a given. And I think people are very suspicious of literary works that include or center on pleasure, happiness, contentment. But of course, these things are part of our lives.
But the kind of contentment that this poem is describing, it isn't even like ecstasy or the big happiness. It's merely contentment.
It's a small bit of contentment, and I think the poem gets a little more complicated than that later on.
Why don't you read it for us?
I'd be glad to. It's called Osso Buco. I love the sound of the bone against the plate and the fortress-like look of it lying before me in a moat of risotto, the meat soft as the leg of an angel who has lived a purely airborne existence, and best of all, the secret marrow, the invaded privacy of the animal, prized out with a knife and swallowed down with cold, exhilarating wine. I am swaying now in the hour after dinner, a citizen tilted back on his chair, a creature with a full stomach, something you don't hear much about in poetry, that sanctuary of hunger and deprivation. You know, the driving rain, the boots by the door, small birds searching for berries in winter. But tonight, the lion of contentment has placed a warm, heavy paw on my chest, and I can only close my eyes and listen to the drums of woe throbbing in the distance and the sound of my wife's laughter on the telephone in the next room, the woman who cooked the savory osso buco, who pointed to show the butcher the one she wanted, she who talks to her faraway friend while I linger here at the table with a hot companionable cup of tea, feeling like one of the friendly natives, a reliable guide, maybe even the chief's favorite son. Somewhere a man is crawling up a rocky hillside on bleeding knees and palms, an Irish penitent carrying the stone of the world in his stomach, and elsewhere people of all nations stare at one another across a long empty table. But here the candles give off their warm glow, the same light that Shakespeare and Isaac Walton wrote by, the light that lit and shadowed the faces of history. Only now it plays on the blue plates, the crumpled napkins, the crossed knife and fork. In a while, one of us will go up to bed, and the other one will follow. Then we will slip below the surface of the night into miles of water, drifting down and down to the dark, soundless bottom, until the weight of dreams pulls us lower still, below the shale and layered rock, beneath the strata of hunger and pleasure, into the broken bones of the earth itself, into the marrow of the only place we know.
How did you decide to write that poem?
I think I started, I don't know where the poems are going. Most poets say that, but it does tend to be true. I think I did start with simply an attempt to write a little poem in praise of a pleasure of eating this terrific meal. I didn't know where it was going, and I think of the poems as little journeys or little rides, if you will, as kind of cheap forms of transportation. And I like to end up in a very different place at the end of the poem than I started at the beginning. And here I start at the kitchen table and I end up kind of in the middle of the earth. So it's that kind of travel that interests me. I think it's a little like writing the poem and not knowing exactly where you're going. It's a little like driving a car at night where the headlights allow you to see ahead of yourself just so far in order to keep the thing going, but you can't see any farther than that.
My guest is poet Billy Collins. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Let's get back to our 1998 interview with poet Billy Collins. This week, he was appointed our next poet laureate.
A lot of your poems have to do with sleep and dreams. Several of your poems end there. Some of your poems are just totally about that. And I'm wondering if sleep is often restful for you.
I'm just lazy, is what you're implying. Well, Keats is the great poet of sleep and dreams and drowsiness, which was thought to be a kind of a receptive state of mind. It might be that I just have too much time on my hands. Max Beerbohm once said that the hardest thing about being a poet was knowing what to do with the other 23 and a half hours in the day.
Right. How long are you going to really sit there and write?
That's right.
Yeah. So do you take a lot of naps?
I do when I can, yes. Waking up from a nap or from sleep is a very good state in which to think about things to write about and even to begin writing. Before the language of the world has a chance to infiltrate your ears, before you hear the radio or someone else talking or read a newspaper, I think that's a good time to write, because I think language can be fresher in those occasions when you're closer to sleep.
You have a poem called The Night House, which is in part about sleep and the difference between the waking mind and the unconscious mm-hmm. mind, the sleeping mind.
It's a poem. It's kind of a meditation on, another great time to write, of course, is as a response to insomnia. And I suppose the poem is kind of a meditation on insomnia, and also a sense that things happen when we're asleep. You know how in those old cartoons, like the teapot and all the things in the kitchen come alive, but this is a sense that the body itself begins to kind of go off in its own directions. Shall I read it?
Please.
The Night House. Every day, the body works in the fields of the world, mending a stone wall or swinging a sickle through the tall grass, the grass of civics, the grass of money. And every night the body curls around itself and listens for the soft bells of sleep. But the heart is restless and rises from the body in the middle of the night, leaves the trapezoidal bedroom with its thick, pictureless walls to sit by herself at the kitchen table and heat some milk in a pan. And the mind gets up too, puts on a robe and goes downstairs, lights a cigarette and opens a book on engineering. Even the conscience awakens and roams from room to room in the dark, darting away from every mirror like a strange fish. And the soul is up on the roof in her nightdress, straddling the ridge, singing a song about the wildness of the sea until the first rip of pink appears in the sky. Then they will all return to the sleeping body, the way a flock of birds settles back into a tree, resuming their daily colloquy, talking to each other or themselves, even through the heat of the long afternoons. Which is why the body, that house of voices, sometimes puts down its metal tongs, its needle, or its pen, to stare into the distance, to listen to all its names being called, before bending again to its labor.
That's a beautiful poem.
Thank you, Terry.
You know, on those nights when you can't sleep, when you do have insomnia, do you panic about life in general?
That nervousness, the anxiety or the coffee or whatever it is that doesn't let you sleep, is something that makes the pen jitter. I mean, this is the stuff that I think poets, wag their tails over. It is a nervous response. It is a nervous sign that there's some turbulence or some disturbance in your inner life. And for me, one of the functions or one of the beauties of poetry is that it's something to do with your inner life. It's an activity. The writing and the construction of poems is an external activity that brings the inner life out of yourself and gives you a way to deal with it and understand it.
Billy Collins, I love your poems. I want to thank you so much for reading some of them for us. I wish we had time for some more.
The pleasure's been all mine, Terry.
Billy Collins recorded in 1998. This week he was appointed our next poet laureate. He assumes his duties in the fall. A new collection of his poems will be published in September. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by blues singer and guitarist John Lee Hooker. He died in his sleep yesterday at the age of 83. Hooker started recording in the late 40s. His songs were also recorded by the Rolling Stones, Canned Heat, The Animals, and ZZ Top. This John Lee Hooker recording, I'm in the Mood, sold a million copies in 1951.
I'm in the mood for love. I'm in the mood, baby. I'm in the mood for love. I said, nighttime is the right time to be with the one you love. You know when night come, baby, God know you so far away. I'm in the mood. I'm in the mood. I'm in the mood for love. I'm in the mood, in the mood. Baby, I'm in the mood for love. Told me to leave that girl alone, but my mother didn't know what that little girl was putting down. I'm in the mood. I'm in the mood, baby.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Vintage Books, a division of Random House and publishers of the new paperback novel White Teeth by Zadie Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Alan Ball, the creator of the new HBO series 6 Feet Under, about a family that owns a funeral home. Ball won an Academy Award for his screenplay for the film American Beauty. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.